From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The comic book series Sin City starts in a lousy room in a lousy part of town. As the name implies, Sin City is a setting of crime, corruption, revenge, and passion. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Frank Miller and Robert Rodriguez about their new film adaptation of Sin City, which is based on Miller's books. Also, British writer Ian McEwan talks about his new bestseller, Saturday. He says he wanted to capture what life is like in this century, in a post-9/11 world. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Sin City, is based on the comic book series of the same name by Frank Miller. The Sin is short for Basin City. It's a place that thrives on corruption, revenge, and passion. One character promises there's going to be blood for blood and by the gallons. The stories deliver on the promise. The film version of this urban nightmare stays true to the comics' film noir feel, following the book's ink drawings nearly frame by frame. The cast includes Bruce Willis, Mickey Rourke, and Jessica Alba. Robert Rodriguez initiated the film adaptation. He co-wrote and co-directed it with Miller and also served as cinematographer. Rodriguez's other films include El Mariachi, Desperado, and Spy Kids. Before we meet Miller and Rodriguez, here's a scene from Sin City. One part of town has been ruled by prostitutes who kicked out the pimps and the cops. But after the women kill a man who turns out to be a cop, they know the cops will want to get even and that their days of free reign are over. Here's Rosaria Dawson and her sometimes lover Clive Owen, who helped kill the cop.
We'll fight the cops and the mob and anybody else who tries to move in on us. We'll go to war.
Don't be stupid, Gail. You wouldn't stand a chance. Get me a car.
Who do you think you are? Giving orders. You got what you wanted out of us. You got what you wanted out of me.
If I don't make it, you can have your war. A hardtop with a decent engine, and make sure it's got a big trunk.
I'll always love you, baby.
Always. Never.
I asked Frank Miller if he could describe his original concept for the Sin City comics.
Sure, there's a little bit of irony there, because I first showed up in New York City. I mean, I'm basically a country boy from Vermont. I first showed up in New York City with a bunch of drawings of tough guys in trench coats and you know, and beautiful women and vintage cars, and tried to sell myself as a comic book artist when all they were really willing to publish at the time were guys in tights punching each other out. So I had to learn how to do that. And that took me away from my tough guys and my vintage cars and all the stuff that would eventually become Sin City. And across the way, I gained enough notoriety to get Hollywood's attention and was hired to work on the movies for a while. And I was kind of startled at that time to realize how little control a writer has in a movie, how little control almost anybody has at the onset when they're still working out the movie. So I spent a long time working in movies, at least it felt like a long time, and a couple years after, a couple years of doing that, and I sat down at my drawing board, not having drawn for 2 years, which was a first in my life, and I just decided I would draw the comic book I always wanted to do. The hell with the comic book industry, the hell with Hollywood. And out came Sin City, and of all things, this drags me back into the movies.
Yeah, right. You know, it's funny, did you say that you were from Vermont?
Yes.
Oh, that is so great, because Sin City is like your basic urban nightmare. I mean,
yeah.
All the cops are corrupt. Everybody's out for revenge. Blood is like pouring through the streets. Most of the women are prostitutes, which isn't your typical Vermont town, that's for sure.
No.
So where does this like urban landscape come from?
I was in love with the big city from when I was a little kid before I ever saw it. I was like, it was like the Emerald City to me, New York was. And I just, my fantasies all revolved around the city. And when I moved here, I fell in love. It was as if I should have been born here.
So, I mean, did you crave the kind of violence and blood in your life that's in the comics? Is that the urban?
Well,
is that the city you were looking for?
I think we all crave intense sensation, and when you put that into fantasy, it comes across as intense. And often it's something you can feel as pleasure rather than pain. But no, the couple times I've been punched in the jaw, I didn't enjoy it a bit. And it's not something I'd recommend to anybody. But I think that melodrama is really the realm of intensities, be they violent or sexual. And once you stop thinking realistically about them, it all kind of makes sense. It's not happening to us. It's happening to these people on the pages and on the screen.
No, one of the things you have in your comic, Frank Miller, is fantastic tough guy, hard-boiled writing, and which the film is really true to. I'm going to ask you to read a passage. Why don't you just like describe what's happening here and then read this passage for us?
Okay. our hero, John Hartigan, played by Bruce Willis, is being beaten up by a rotten cop who's attempting to get a false confession out of him for a crime he didn't commit. And he knows his life is virtually over, and he's explaining why he can't give them what they want, because they're willing to give him his freedom. God knows why I didn't die there like I should have, back there on that rotten, blood-soaked dock where I rescued skinny little Nancy Callahan from that pervo son of a senator, where my partner filled me with 6 magnum slugs and nailed together with the first few pieces of the frame they've stuck me in. Yeah, I should have died back there on that dock. I should have died, and I wish I had, to the extent that I wish for anything. Past worrying, past giving a damn. It's like it's all happening to somebody else. The wet sounds of impact stop. My head rolls around on my shoulders. My mouth coughs out a wad of blood. All on their own. Without me asking them to, my lungs expand, sucking in dusty, hot air, rusty old factory air. Detective Leibowitz gives out with a trombone deep beer belch and chuckles. He's getting angry.
That's a real tough guy style of writing. What inspired you to write in that style?
I don't know, really. I've always been drawn to it. I think partly because things have gone so much the other way in fiction, whether it be pop or literature or whatever, that I think there's a beauty to the core of the American hard-boiled writing that goes all the way back to Dashiell Hammett and even Hemingway, but found it's my most poetic voice in Raymond Chandler. And I guess I just respond to it because I love morality plays. And Sin City is, for all of its grew, deeply romantic. And I mean, it's called Sin City because the basic subject of Sin City is virtue.
Robert Rodriguez, what is the combination of film and computer graphics and drawing that you used in order to get that pulpy comic book look in a live action movie?
The thing is, you normally would shoot on film and shoot on real sets. And if you ever look at even your favorite black and white movie, and it's really gray and white because there's so many midtones and colors that just go to a sort of drab gray. And what's great about Frank's books being pen and ink is that he used no midtones at all. He would just use a straight black and a straight white. Sometimes blood would be white in order to show up against the black. And it was a very almost negative images going on. And I thought, that's what I want the film to look like. I want it to be that punchy. And by shooting digital, by shooting in front of a green screen where we could separate the actors from each other and from the sets that we can put in digitally later and make very simple, like an ink drawing, and take out those midtones. That's why when you watch the movie, the black and white is of an inky quality that you would not see in any other movie. And then we'd throw in color on top of that, splashes of color, and it becomes very abstract. It becomes very almost like conceptual art.
Now, there's so much violence in both the Sin City comics and in the movie, including, you know, mutilation, beheading, dismemberment. Frank Miller, why did you want that degree of violence? And these are all, a lot of this is stuff that just doesn't really happen, like there's somebody with with a swastika-shaped razor who can, and she can like hurl it and sever your hand off. I mean, thank goodness this doesn't, as far as I know, exist in real life. But why did you want to head in that direction in your fantasy life?
I'm not a believer in restraint, really, when it comes to fiction, because I believe there's a distinct difference between reality and fiction that has to be observed. And I often dive into my stories wishing to create a fever dream. Even though I put a lot of preparation into the plotting, when I start executing, I work very quickly, and I want to push things to extremes because I want to get a reaction out of the people who read it. Also, I come from a field and an art form, comics, that do not have the rather notorious punch that film does. And part of my job is getting people's attention. I've also got to say that after after 60-some years of this utterly sanitized Batman and Superman stuff where the heroes become deputies and all the cops are honest, somebody had to crack that egg open and really make some noise.
What does it do to your imagination when your goal is to let it go and find the most sadistic parts to mine?
It's releasing. I mean, I think that's really what Sin City is. It happens in a perverse never land. You never know what part of the country you're in. I mean, some days it has palm trees, the other days it has water towers that look like straight from New York. Occasionally I'll steal a skyscraper from Chicago. I mean, you know it's in America, but you don't know exactly where it is. And there's very lonely, isolated, intimate stories. The idea is to capture those moments of great decision and of grave sacrifice and all of that. But in the middle of all of that, to make for some as much sick humor as possible.
And there is a reason why it also seems so, so much of a good thing in the movie, and it's because I put three of his books together, so it feels even more relentless because it'd be this equivalent of getting three of Frank's books and reading them back to back to back, three in a row. So by the end of the movie, you're going, oh my God, there was beheadings, there was this disembowelments, but that's because there were three stories put together. He didn't craft it to be that. I had just put that together in order to give people a better sense of what Sin City was about rather than just taking one story and padding it out to feature length. So it's really not true to his books in that way, in that you are getting a little too much all at once in the movie version of it. But I thought it was worth doing anyway, just to give people a better sense of the world.
My guests are Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller. They co-wrote and co-directed the new film Sin City, which is based on Miller's comic books of the same name. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh. My guests are Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller. They co-wrote and co-directed the new film Sin City, which is based on Miller's comic books of the same name. Let's talk about the drawing of the people. The men are big and muscular, kind of hulking. The women, most of the women in your stories are, particularly in one story, are prostitutes. And as you say in the book, in Sin City, the ladies are the law here, beautiful and merciless. If you've got the cash and you play by the rules, they'll make all your dreams come true. But if you cross them, you're a corpse.
That's an important distinction, actually. Is that
can we use her voice in the movie, Robert?
Yeah, no, that's great, though. But that's actually a section of Sin City. That's not really all of Sin City. When they talk about Old Town, that's the red light district.
Well, let's talk about this section. This is the red light district. And,
well, what they've done is they've killed all the pimps and they've struck their deal with the cops, and you can't mess with these girls.
And they are dressed in your basic fetish attire.
I borrowed a lot from Versace. I've got to admit.
Yeah, they're dressed in your basic, like leather corsets and chokers and boots. And I mean, all they need is like the whips. But instead they have like heavy automated weapons. So,
Terry, I've got to tell you, the cartoonist's dirty little secret is that we tend to do stories that involve things we like to draw.
So that's you know what? That stuff actually makes great drawings, too. I mean, the costumes he drew in the book, you could see why from a pen and ink standpoint he would choose those costumes. And that was the first thing we tried when we went to do the movie. So, let's try actually making that suit for real. And if it doesn't work, we'll modify it. But all Frank's clothing designs worked quite remarkably, actually.
Is that drawing a part an homage to some of the artists who did that? I mean, a lot of this work has been collected now, from the 50s, that kind of 1950s fetish pinup girl type of
Actually, no. I mean, it really wasn't because it was the 50s people I owe much more to are artists like Wallace Wood and Johnny Craig and Will Eisner from the same period who did the crime stuff. I just was trying to figure out what all my hookers would be wearing. And I was at a bookstore with my wife, and she showed me this book of Versace. And then we started gathering these magazines, and I realized that there was this endless wealth of stuff that was preposterous and funny and fun to look at.
You're talking about Versace, like ridiculous... the fashion designer?
Yes. He went out and checked out Fifth Avenue hookers for some of his costume designs. And so they ended up being... And the whole idea is in City, you're walking down this grimy street and you see a hooker and she's dressed in an outfit that would have cost her $80,000. It makes no sense, but it's my fantasy.
How did you learn to draw very curvaceous women? Which has... The women in your comics are not... they don't have eating disorders.
No, they don't. Just study, I guess. You know, there are people I learned from in cartooning and all through illustration. But it's just in working up the way characters look, I tend to come up with simplest possible shapes, and as soon as I've simplified them enough, I know that I've got them where I want them. When I was doing Marv, for instance, as soon as I took out the bridge of his nose and made his shoulders huge, the rest of him started falling together. And when it came to the girls, they're of course impossibly proportioned, but the idea is to break it into as few curves as possible to evoke as much as possible from the reader. So it owes more to hieroglyphs than it does to literature.
So when you say impossibly proportioned, really narrow waist, really big chest.
And
curvaceous
the hips.
Yeah. So, Robert Rodriguez, how did you approach casting real women to play these impossible fantasies?
He found that was the word impossible.
Well, the thing, yeah, that was one of the main things I wanted to find out too. I needed to find out what kind of guy Frank is when I looked at these drawings, and when I realized he was just like the rest of us. He very much is a stylist, and when he told me that he was more interested and took more time drawing their faces, then I knew I had the right co-director because if you see any of my movies, they're mostly always close-ups. They're always right in people's faces and closer and closer because I operate the camera and I get closer and closer to someone's face, which I find the more interesting. So we really did cast the actresses and the actors for their faces.
One of the people you cast in Sin City was Mickey Rourke, who plays that hulking character of Marv.
Marv, yeah.
And, of course, you'd never recognize him because he's wearing a prosthetic face.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why you did that. Is it because Mickey Rourke didn't have the right face, or you couldn't find an actor with the right face? Or
oh, nobody would have the
nobody
face of
would
Marv.
Have the face.
If you see the drawings, it's the most iconic character in the whole book series, and he shows up several times. And when people think of Sin City, they think of Marv, and he's got this very angular face. And I just thought it was important that whoever played him would have that. And the only person I could think to play him was Mickey Rourke. I had just worked with him on another movie called Once Upon a Time in Mexico and got to know him off the set there. And when I went and looked at Sin City again, and I looked at it, I went, I know this guy. It's Mickey. Mickey is Marv. I mean, he's as close as we can get to a Marv without getting hurt. He's got that very, very tortured soul quality to him. And I showed it to him, and I did some drawings over his face and thought, yeah, I can actually, we can turn his face into the face of Marv. So, and it really helped Mickey because he could really get into the character because he wasn't playing, a variation on himself. He was coming in and playing somebody completely. And he really got into it.
Since we've been talking about an urban nightmare that Frank Miller, you created in the Sin City comics, and that Frank Miller and Robert Rodriguez, you've created together in the movie version of Sin City, I'd be interested in hearing if you each have an urban nightmare moment to share that fed your vision of what the nightmarish urban landscape would look like. If there was like an image or a threatening moment that you were each exposed to, that fed your fantasies for Sin City.
Sure. Well, I mean, I could offer a few, but one in particular stands out. I was out one night very late, my first year in Manhattan. You know, this country boy who didn't know which way was up, with this loud talking Puerto Rican guy, and we were out very late at night, and he got the idea to bother some bread makers you know, some bakers for a loaf of bread, and he banged on their back door until they gave us a loaf of bread, and we kept walking through the Lower West Side, and a hooker with extraordinarily long legs went by, and he started calling her Daddy Long Legs and following after her, and I kind of pulled the guy away from this nonsense. We walked another block, and a very jittery junkie confronted us with a switchblade. And it started demanding money we didn't have. And I thought, well, this is about the dumbest death I could have asked for, and here it comes, because I don't have any money, and this guy's got a knife. Well, the compadre I had, he just starts laughing. The next thing I know, the switchblade's flown across the street, and the guy's flat on his back, smashed to pieces. And my acquaintance Wilfredo turns to me and says, "Well, can I tell you, a black belt?"
Well,
kicked his.
It was about 4 in the morning.
I think that's even better than stuff in your book. That's a great story. Me, I have no such interesting tales. My sisters lived in New York, but I have some friends who lived in Mexico City, and they had some wild tales to tell me. But I was not witness to any of those.
Frank Miller, you were initially reluctant to have a film adaptation of Sin City. Now that it's out there, how do you feel?
Initially, that was about 12 years, yeah. I was reluctant for about 12 years.
So how do you feel now that there is a movie?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in heaven. When do we start number 2, man?
He's got 7 books, you know, so we could just keep going.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thanks a lot, Terry. It's great to talk with you.
Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller co-wrote and co-directed the new film Sin City, which is based on Miller's comic books of the same name. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel Night and Day in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, creating a legacy of physical and emotional health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, British writer Ian McEwan talks about his new best-selling novel, Saturday. It takes place during one day of a neurosurgeon's life just before the invasion of Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ian McEwan, is regarded by many as the best British novelist of his generation. Several of his books were adapted into films, including The Comfort of Strangers, The Cement Garden, The Good Son, and Enduring Love. His new novel, Saturday, was a bestseller in England and just hit the bestseller list in the States. It tells the story of 24 hours in the life of a neurosurgeon in London. On this day, shortly before the invasion of Iraq, a huge anti-war demonstration is filling the streets. Even upon waking, he's reminded that he's living in a post-September 11th world. He looks out the window, sees a plane in flames flash across the sky, and assumes it's an act of terrorism. Later in the day, he learns it's not, but here's what he's thinking as he looks out the window in the early morning, imagining what the passengers are experiencing, thinking about how he's sometimes let his own imagination wander while flying.
Plastic fork in hand, he often wonders how it might go. The screaming in the cabin partly muffled by that deadening acoustic. The fumbling in bags for phones and last words. The airline staff in their terror clinging to remembered fragments of procedure. The leveling smell of excrement. But the scene construed from the outside, from afar like this, is also familiar. It's already almost 18 months since half the planet watched and watched again the unseen captives driven through the sky to the slaughter, at which time they gathered round the innocent silhouette of any jet plane, a novel association. Everyone agrees. Airliners look different in the sky these days, predatory or doomed. Henry knows it's a trick of vision that makes him think he can see an outline now, a deeper black shape against the dark. The howl of the burning engine continues to rise in pitch. It wouldn't surprise him to see lights coming on across the city or the squares fill with residents in dressing gowns. Behind him, Rosalind, well practiced at excluding the city's night troubles from her sleep, turns on her side. The noise is probably no more intrusive than a passing siren on the Euston Road. The fiery white core and its coloured tail have grown larger. No passenger sitting in that central section of the plane could survive. And that is the other familiar element, the horror of what he can't see, catastrophe observed from a safe distance, watching death on a large scale, but seeing no one die, no blood, no screams, no human figures at all, and into this emptiness, the obliging imagination set free. The fight to death in the cockpit, a posse of brave passengers assembling before a last hope charge against the fanatics. To escape the heat of that fire, which part of the plane might you run to? The pilot's end might seem less lonely somehow. Is it pathetic folly to reach into the overhead locker for your bag, or necessary optimism? Will the thickly made-up lady who politely served you your croissant and jam now be trying to stop you?
That's Ian McEwan reading from his new novel, Saturday. This book opens with what the character describes as catastrophe observed from a great distance. What interests you in that, in the sense of observing catastrophe from this distance, a distance from which you can only see the outline of what's happening and you're helpless to really do anything to stop it?
Well, I suppose in the sort of community of our anxiety, that's something we all share. I'm sure that most of the planet watched those events of 9/11. And to me, one of the most sinister aspects of it was of seeing things happen from a distance and having to set your imagination free into the, into the terror that you couldn't actually witness. I mean, what was going on in those cabins in those last minutes. So it's that sense of dreamlike distance where you can only guess at the human terror. It's all sort of concealed, safely concealed from you by the very fact of distance.
I've seen several reviews that describe your novel, Saturday, as a post-September 11th book. And I'm wondering if you see the book as trying to respond to that question, like, what kind of art matters after September 11th? Were you trying to respond to that, or did the subject come out of a different question?
It really came from a different direction for me. I had written a novel called Atonement, which was a historical novel, and I'd already decided, long before 9/11, that I was going to set a novel very much in the present. I wanted to get a flavour of the days we live in. I then discovered we were living in days that were sort of horribly interesting. The invasion of Afghanistan following the events of 9/11, then the long, drawn-out march, as it were, to Iraq through the UN, and a great nervousness descending on Western countries, especially in the cities. And I guess I was lucky, if you could call it that, that right near my house in central London, many of the marchers gathered to protest against the upcoming invasion of Iraq. More than a million people marched in central London that day. And that suddenly gave me my focus. I thought, well, this is the day. You know, this march will be the background for my man, my neurosurgeon, as he goes about his business, playing squash, visiting his dying mother, and so on.
But, you know, that march, this huge march protesting the impending invasion of Iraq, is all kind of like background noise for him. You know, he's not participating in it. He's thinking occasionally about his position on invading Iraq. He's not for war. He's an anti-war kind of person, but he thinks, you know, maybe in the long run this won't be a bad thing. So, but mostly the protest is backdrop. It's a traffic jam. It's crowds.
Yeah.
It's noise in the background. Why take something that momentous and put it in the background?
Well, it's very much in the foreground of Henry's thoughts. It's in the background of where he physically is. But, I mean, he has a passionate row towards the end of this novel with his daughter, you know, who's furiously against the war. Henry is ambivalent. You know, he can see that this could be a disaster. At the same time, he's treated an Iraqi professor of history who's been tortured under the regime, and that's led him to read up a great deal about the nature of this what one friend of mine called an abattoir state. And from the point of view of a novelist, I think a rich state of ambivalence is more productive, really. Than, you know, it's not my interest, for example, in this novel to tell people what to think about events in Iraq. So it moves in and out of his anxieties in a very strong way indeed. I mean, it's always there. It's part, in other words, it gives a focus to all his anxieties about the state of the world we're in.
Your main character, the neurosurgeon, doesn't much like literature, though his daughter, who is a young poet, loves fiction and is kind of assigning her father books to read for him to catch up on. And he, you know, he reads his assignments but doesn't feel particularly moved by what he's reading. There's a few lines I'd like you to read on page 65.
He doesn't want to spend his days off, lying or even sitting down, nor does he really want to be a spectator of other lives, of imaginary lives, even though these past hours he's put in an unusual number of minutes gazing from the bedroom window. And it interests him less to have the world reinvented. He wants it explained. The times are strange enough. Why make things up?
Now, how did you come with these reasons to not appreciate fiction?
Well, I mean, I suppose one of the pleasures and privileges of writing a novel is you can take a tiny shred of your own impulses or thoughts and sort of irresponsibly pass them off as someone else's. And in those immediate 6 or 9 months after 9/11, I found myself reading anything but fiction. I didn't want the world invented at that point. I wanted to be informed about it. So I read books on Islam, I read books on imperialism, on the economics of the Middle East, and so on. And I don't think I was alone in this, too. I think there was a huge sort of thirst for explanations or, you know, for ways of trying to understand what had happened and what we were heading towards. And then, of course, out of that, I began to passionately want to make things up. But what I've given here to Henry is a sort of little game I played, because poor fellow, he's trapped in a novel by me, you know, whatever he thinks about novels, you know, he's in one. And also his day is actually going to the logic of his day is going to bring him through a series of events that suggest, in fact, that literature has far more power than he can dream of. I suppose, too, I mean, I wrote a novel about a girl, a little girl, Bryony Tallis, in Atonement, who was so passionate about literature, couldn't really see the world in any other terms but the terms of fiction and romance. And I thought, well, I'm going to write an antidote, you know, have someone who not only loathes, you know, he doesn't loathe books, he tries hard, but he's very suspicious and thinks they're rather overrated. Actually, one of the books he dislikes most is by me. So, I mean, he doesn't like magical realism, for example, and he's very dismissive of writers like Angela Carter and Paul Auster and Gunter Grass.
Let me quote him for a second. He says, "No more magic midget drummers," he pleaded with the reporter. "Please, no more ghosts, angels, satans, or metamorphoses. When anything can happen, nothing much matters. It's all kitsch to me."
Yeah. He feels really that fiction, if it's got to have any role at all, must engage with the actual, with the plausible, and plausibly reinvent it. And again, I'm giving to him in very extreme form a kind of impulse of mine, which is, you know, I want to engage in this novel, although not necessarily in all novels that I write. But in this particular novel, I'm engaged with the actual, you know, this time, now, this man, you know, this city, this century.
My guest is Ian McEwan. His new novel is called Saturday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Ian McEwan, and his new novel is called Saturday. One of the funny things about your main character, the neurologist, is, you know, he's a very rational, analytical person. He doesn't like fiction. But in a way, he has the mind of a writer because he is always thinking and always describing. And that need to always describe is something, I mean, that's just inherent to him. Don't you think in some ways he has a writer's instinct?
Well, I suppose, too, that...
That's because of you.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure there's any way around this.
Right.
But, you know, I had to describe his day, and I sort of do it over his shoulder, really, in a third person. But yes, I mean, the novel ends with a longish description of a piece of neurosurgery, which actually Henry has to perform on the very man who's intruded into his house. And... I suppose behind that, I was maybe describing not only the focus and attention and concentration of writing itself, but maybe of a kind of happiness we don't really have a word for in English, or maybe perhaps not in any other language, that peculiar kind of muted joy when you're so focused on something that all time and all selfhood goes from you. You're not even conscious of being happy at the time. You're just sort of weightless, doing the thing that you're engaged in, maybe using some learned skills, maybe trying to overcome difficulties, maybe working with other people, but you are absolutely liberated into a sort of timeless sense. And you can get that with a game of tennis or doing a bit of carpentry or even gardening. I noticed that neurosurgery allows... practitioners to almost of necessity experience it by the day for hours on end. It is so demanding that your mind cannot be anywhere else. And certainly my sort of guide, Neil Kitchen, who's a senior neurosurgeon in London, said that once he got into the operating theatre, everything else dropped away. Whatever else was going on in his life, in his work, in his home, or whatever else, he was set free with no sense of passing time. And I suppose that's the state that many writers would love to get to with their writing, you know, to have one of those mornings where 3 hours can go by, you don't even look at the clock, you don't crave coffee, you don't divert yourself with phone calls or emails, and you just live in this sort of timeless joy.
The main character's mother in your new novel has dementia, and she's living in an institution for that. I know your mother had a form of dementia. Did you base this character on your experiences with your mother in the last years of her life?
Oh, very much so. I mean, she had a form of vascular dementia, which is exactly what Lily, I call her, in this novel has. And like many people in their 50s, I've watched a parent empty out in that sort of horrifying way, the mind, that emptying out process is really like a sort of, it's like a death, really. And you end up finally with the body, but not the personality. Very tough for everyone around. Strangely, for my mother, it wasn't Alzheimer's, which has a much bigger component of sort of mood swing and aggression. This was relatively benign for her once she had crossed the line and could no longer remember who she was and lived in a sort of constant present, a tiny window of the present, no sense of what happened a minute ago. She would speak these extraordinary sentences, and I would come away from some visits thinking, I can't make up those sentences. They are so fragmented and upended and yet so grammatically correct. So next time I saw her, I said, look, do you mind when we're speaking that if I write? And she said, fine, go ahead. She didn't know who I was, but at that point. And I started to write down some of her conversation, and nearly all of the things that Lily says in the novel were things said by my mother, and it felt to me like a kind of, I don't know, a kind of tribute to catching the last days of her life.
What's one of those lines that you remembered that you gave to Lily in the book?
Well, shall I read one?
Sure.
Lily suddenly speaks up. Her mood is anxious, even a little querulous. And you know that this, you know, Auntie, she calls everyone Auntie. You know, Auntie, what people put on their shoes to make them, you know, shoe polish? He never understands why she calls him Auntie, or which of her many aunts is haunting her. No, they put it all over their shoes and rub it with a cloth. Well, anyway, it's a bit like shoe polish. It's that sort of thing. We had side plates and God knows what all along the street. We had everything but the right thing because we were in the wrong place. Then she suddenly laughs. It's become clearer to her. If you turn the picture round and take the back off like I did, you get such a lot of pleasure out of it. It's all what it meant, and the laugh we had out of it. And she laughs gaily, just like she used to. And he laughs too. It's all what it meant. So there was a sort of strong emotional content to what she was saying, but she was talking of squeezing herself through certain gaps between people and things. And you felt you almost knew what she was talking about, but never quite.
It's almost like this surrealistic philosophy.
Yes, it's all what it meant. Is something that, you know, she certainly did say.
How important was it to you to see her, knowing that she wouldn't know who you were anyways?
It's odd, because I, like Henry Perrone, I used to not look forward to going and try and put it off. And even then say to myself, well, look, it won't make any difference because she's not expecting me because she doesn't remember me, and she won't remember me the minute after I've gone. But I don't know. I think it's just the habits of, you know, of love and human association. You know, your mother is ill, she's in hospital or in a home. You've got to go and you've got to see her. And maybe, and this was a rather chilling thought, maybe it's not about the present anyway, it's about the past. That actually he's trying, and I was trying, still to keep alive or capture associations of when she was fully conscious, when she was fully herself.
Toward the end of your book, your main character is looking ahead, and is looking ahead to what he thinks will be a life of constant diminishment as he gets older. He's approaching his 50th birthday.
Mm.
And he's thinking ahead to, you know, him losing his physical powers and mental powers and becoming dependent on children and so on. And as you go through middle age, I'm wondering what it's like for you to think about those things yourself, and at the same time, try to avoid all the kind of cliches that, do you know what I mean, that people promise themselves they won't fall into?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult. You reach a certain point in life, and suddenly your stash of days is looking finite. And they always were finite, but you didn't actually feel that when you were 27. And in theory, at least, that should make you approach each day with a kind of renewed determination to make the most of it. But in fact, you know, habits form and things solidify. And so, yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I think mortality tends to become a writer's subject as he or she gets to a certain age. Although I think there, you know, there are a trillion ways in which that subject can be addressed, and sometimes it comes through in a writer's work, not head on, but in a certain sort of valedictory quality, a sense of a, you know, it could be over several novels, a sense of a long goodbye.
My guest is Ian McEwan. His new novel is called Saturday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ian McEwan. His new best-selling novel is called Saturday. In March of 2004, you were delayed from entering the United States from Canada. You were coming here for a series of speaking engagements, and that got a lot of a lot of attention in the newspapers. How has that affected? Well, maybe you could very briefly describe the reason why you were detained, or not, I shouldn't say detained, but maybe I should say detained. What would be the right word?
Well, the right word, no, turn back.
Turn back, okay.
Yeah,
there you go.
I was trying to come into the States. I was giving a lecture. Actually, 3,000 people were waiting for me in, the next day in Seattle. Because I was being paid for the lecture, the Homeland Security guy eventually, after many hours, turned me back, and I had to enlist the help of the State Department, plus the British consul in Vancouver, and they got me in the next day. I got a fulsome letter of apology from Homeland Security saying that, you know, they'd made a mistake. But having said that, I mean, I, you know, for this visit, I was then told I should reapply for a visa. British citizens don't usually need visas, but now my passport and the computer has the memory of me being denied entry, refused entry. And I only got in with this by the skin of my teeth, and I have to say,
this time around?
This time around, and this may be the last time I ever come to the States, because it is, I don't know, I've fallen into a bureaucratic mess. A nine-month application to a visa only just succeeded on the day I was leaving. It arrived at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it only allows me into the country for the time that I'm, you know, here to talk about this book. We had asked for a five-year visa. So it's become very difficult, and I know I feel rather perplexed. This is a country I have deep love for, and I find I'm not welcome by its bureaucracy, and I hope we'll get this sorted out, but it's become very, very difficult indeed.
There's a scene in your novel in which your main character is at, I forget whether it's a party or it's some kind of reception, and Tony Blair is there. And Tony Blair introduces himself and starts talking about how much he likes this guy's paintings. And of course, he's not a painter. He's a neurologist. But there's no polite way of correcting Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Has this ever happened to you while we're on the subject of identity?
Actually, well, it was at the opening of the Tate Modern Art Gallery. I was there with my wife, and we went for a little stroll with our champagnes through the newly opened work. And we were looking in the Rothkos. Then we came into another room, and there was Tony Blair and the art director of the gallery doing a photo opportunity, and lots of journalists and photographers standing behind a braided rope, taking pictures. And the gallery director sort of waved at my wife. He knew her and brought the Prime Minister over to meet us. And the 60-odd strong retinue surrounded us, you know, flunkies and security men and journalists and diarists with their pens ready. And when the Prime Minister shook my hand, he said hello to my wife, and then he shook my hand and he said, "I really admire your work." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." He said, "Yeah, we got two of your paintings hanging in Downing Street." And I said, no. And he said, yes. And he went on shaking my hand. And then someone said, "Prime Minister, we've got 2 minutes to be at the front door." And the whole lot of them just swept on, leaving us standing there sort of like rabbits in the headlights. And then the diarists clustered around me and said, "So what did he say? What did he say?" And I thought... quickly, and I said, "The Prime Minister said he really liked my work." And I left it at that because I thought, no, I'm having this story. I'm not giving it to you guys. So I, you know, 2 or 3 years later, used it in this novel.
Well, Ian McEwan, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Ian McEwan's new novel is called Saturday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Genny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has for the first time written about the wounds he suffered in World War II, which nearly killed him and left him temporarily paralyzed. He never regained the use of one arm. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dole about his new memoir, One Soldier's Story. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. My guess.